You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Stentorian blasts of Ludwig von Beethoven. We are back on the air again. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this Thursday, the day before the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as President of the United States. We're here today with my good friend, Mr. Doug O'Brien. He's our Thursday co-host. Hiya, Doug.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing well, and I thought it would be good, since we are on the eve of the inauguration, to have a friend of mine who I've gotten to know over the interwebs over the last few years on the show today as a special guest as well. He is Dr. Daniel Conway. He is an assistant professor of pediatrics at Drexel University, section chief of immunology at St. Christopher's Hospital for Children out in Philadelphia. And his specialties include neonatology and immunology, with particular interest in pediatric immunodeficiencies and pediatric HIV and prevention of perinatal HIV transmission. And I thought it would be good to have him on the show today because we are also looking at the great dynamiting of Obamacare coming up. The plan seems to be we'll push you out of the airplane and then we're going to start working on a parachute for you and we'll get that to you right away. That seems to be the GOP plan. And so I thought it'd be good to have an actual doctor on the show today to talk about some of the possible impacts of the rollback of Obamacare, and also to try and figure out, sort of read the tea leaves a little bit, because we're also seeing now these kind of weird signals coming from Trump that we're going to have health care for everybody, which sounds a lot like Obamacare.
Sounds better than Obamacare.
Yeah. It sounds better than Obamacare. And so it's like, you know, what's going on? Well, you know, I don't really expect Dan to know, but I thought it'd be good to have him on the show. So welcome, Dan Conway, Dr. Great. Dan Conway.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. I've been following the policy on this very closely for a while now. It has a just as a point of reference, I do pediatrics in an underserved area. As a consequence of that, we end up with a lot of individuals who have who get third party payers who are medical assistance third party payers. So we see are privileged in pediatrics to have almost universal health care for all children in the United States. So it's great for pediatrics, excluding the reimbursement, which is often much less than, say, for Medicare for the same diagnostic codes. Mm-hmm. So we have, but it's been great. The ACA has created opportunities for folks over 18 to start having parity with that type of arrangement. We can start seeing subsidized health care in private insurance pools for individuals who have pre-existing conditions, who are, for my patients who leave healthcare, medical assistance, HMOs under their parents and can move into ACA policies. That's been phenomenal for patients with chronic illness. This has been great. I have to say that it has allowed a more seamless chronic care medical model to continue.
Now, but that's the ACA. That's totally different than Obamacare, right? I mean, I've been reading that on the internet repeatedly. unbelievably, I have read multiple times from various people on the internet who are apparently, after all this time, unaware that Obamacare is the same thing as the Affordable Care Act, and are only now discovering that, and hated it because it had Obama's name in it. So, but before we get on, before we start talking about Obamacare, I'd just like to, if you could, you're a Catholic pediatrician, and one of the things that has struck me in our conversation, you've talked a little bit about some of the people who were sort of inspirations for you to pursue medicine. Particularly, you mentioned in one conversation, you mentioned somebody who I think a lot of people don't know anything about or never heard of or have forgotten, namely Dr. Tom Dooley. I was wondering if you could talk about sort of how you wound up becoming a Catholic pediatrician and his influence on you.
So I have, since a young age, in our household in the 70s, we had we got Marinol magazine. We've got St. Anthony's Messenger. In those years and in those magazines, there was, a great emphasis on care of the poor. That was the a huge aspect of the missionary work of Marinol, of the work of the types of commentary that one would see in St. Anthony's Messenger. There was always an article on that, and I can recall, articles on an article on a nun who served the poor in Tutwiler, Mississippi. I still remember the name of that town. And she, in her 40s, went to medical school and went and became a physician, and then served then. And that was an aspect in which that was a way of being Catholic, mm-hmm. and that was a way of being of expression of the faith. And that, coupled with a dynamic in which, Marinol magazine did follow what was going on in El Salvador. Then they lost a lay associate in 1980. So, and then in the midst of all this, my father, who knew that I was looking at medicine, said, "Hey, there's this gentleman named, Tom Dooley." And my mother was very much a fan of Tom Dooley. And so we went, and the library had his books. He had three books, and then an administrator in his organization then produced a fourth book on his life. So, I remember reading those, and they were very inspirational accounts on being a physician in the jungles of Southeast Asia at the same time. At the same time that, every young person going to be a doctor in that period was also influenced by watching a lot of MASH. So, So kind of fits a theme, and it was I was very, very moved by that type of that work, and moved by the sacrifices of these individuals in this organization, and that motivated me to proceed and study and take seriously a call to serve the poor in some way. So then I moved into medicine, and went to St. Joseph's University, went and after interviewing for medical school, how awful that was. That was a horrific experience in the 1980s, where I was shamed at multiple different levels and at multiple different interviews. That was a fairly barbaric experience. I did waver on my thought about going into medicine, and then I went and worked at a Native American school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament, mm-hmm. of a Catherine's group, and mm-hmm. then I went to medical school after that, and continued on. And I think that I really am very excited about my choice. I never regretted it. I'm very happy with where I am, and I've been in North Philadelphia through all my education and my career so far.
Okay, well, this is parable of the sheep and the goats territory, I was sick and you treated me, and that's I have huge respect for that, and So well done.
it's been my privilege, and I never want to, like, it's not a brag so much, it's my privilege to be here. I've been in, again, North Philly has become like a place where I have been I've both lived in and been a physician in, and I'm thrilled to be here. I'm very happy. This is a great place to work.
Well, well done. When we were talking about Tom Dooley, we had this discussion privately over the web some weeks back, and I had sort of dimly been aware of, I'd heard the name, and that was kind of it. But it was interesting. I went and read up on him, and this is a guy who, back in that period in American Catholic history where a Catholic physician would say something like, I'm here to fight communism and disease. Right?
Yes.
And that was really like the mission, right? It was just, that was what he did, went to do, you know? And so it was like, okay, this is good. You know, I admire this man. We're coming up against a break here, but we'll be back. We got about a minute before we go to break. But when we come back, I want to talk, sort of move the discussion now to, how should you put it? Fighting rogue capitalism and disease too, because that's what we're going to be looking at next. With the rollback of Obamacare. So we'll be back with Dr. Dan Conway, Doug O'Brien, here on Connecting the Dots on Breadbox Media. We'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Host Mark Shea, and we're here today with Doug O'Brien, my Thursday co-host, and we're here with a special guest, Dr. Dan Conway. He is a pediatrician working out in North Philadelphia, a Catholic pediatrician, and wanted to have him on the show today because here we are on the eve of the inauguration, and we're watching our intensely pro-life Congress, GOP-dominated Congress, now setting to work on their number one priority, super-duper pro-life priority, of destroying Obamacare. Because that's going to save so many babies. And so I thought it would be good to talk with you today, Dr. Conway, about what some of the effects of the rollback of Obamacare are going to be. What can we ordinary people just who are out here watching, sort of wondering what's going to happen to our medical, I'm somebody who now I've had multiple skin cancer surgeries, as well as, you know, I'm on diabetes care, and I'm not, I don't reckon myself as the least of these in the slightest. You know, your population that you serve, what's going to happen to them? I was wondering if you could talk about that a bit.
One of the things that is understood, that we have to understand about the Affordable Care Act, is that it did rewrite and link many aspects of federal support for medical care. It links lots of payer outcome pieces in Medicare, from the Medicare side and senior citizens down through medical assistance. And I think of that as an age continuum. Medical assistance being more utilized consistently by children and pregnant women, and the disabled. The Affordable Care Act for just those already existing programs will has linked medical assistance expansion to ACA involvement at the state level, has also linked certain population health outcome measurements for hospital systems to Medicare reimbursement rates, as well as for both hospitals as well as for individual physicians. So there are lots of different levels of pieces for the Affordable Care Act, and its immediate linking just outside of what everyone thinks of the Obamacare exchanges and the individual policies that one gets from them. So it's a very complex piece of legislation that can't even just be fully undone just with budget resolutions as the current Congress is just attempting.
Okay.
So that they'll actually have to be laws and such to make it all happen. It's going to have to somehow negotiate the Democrats in the Senate.
Okay. My impression, and this is only my impression because, boy, do I not understand the complexity of this, is that they want to roll it back, but then they don't want to actually make any of the law come into effect anytime soon or something. Is that
right? Yeah.
Is that how it's being proposed? I really, it's kind of baffling for me. I mean, I'm watching the news and trying to figure out what's going on. Is this something that's going to come into effect when?
I think everything that involves anything that involves the budget is going to probably come into effect first around will be 2018. 2017, there's not going to be much. And depending upon the ability to enact this and come up with language through the government, it's going to be 2018 at the earliest budget that it happens. The first things on the agenda, and it's is medical assistance expansion has been something that has been attacked both at the state level as well as the federal government level by the GOP. It's been something that many state governors, who if they're a GOP governor, it's considered somehow a heretical event to have expanded medical assistance provisions for the state, you know, in order to enact aspects of the ACA. So taking that federal money was always considered to be was considered dirty money. So there would be pieces of this that's going to roll back access on the provision, and that's very clearly targeted as aspects and provision of medical care for the Affordable Care Act. The medical assistance piece is going to be pulled back. And again, I say that, and you know, that's fascinating for the pro-life party that's going after the piece that really funds most pregnant women and children in this country.
Mm-hmm. That's the first thing that they're getting rid of?
Yeah. and a piece called CHIP. CHIP is a children's insurance plan that provides a health plan for the working poor, is usually the group for whom that is. So it's kind of like, it's been in existence before Obamacare. It was kind of like Obamacare for the children whose parents have some means and can pay some subsidies and then manage to get insurance through that program.
Okay.
So, the horror that occurs as a consequence of having good medical assistance and a pre-Obamacare type medical insurance program called CHIP resulted in 98% of all the children in the United States being covered by insurance. How awful.
Dear God. I'm well, okay, well, so we're finally putting a stop to that nightmare then.
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, these are born children anyway, so they don't count. we're talking about protection of life from conception to birth, and then after that, you know, those kids are takers. So okay, so that's the first thing that our pro-life party is targeting is children.
In fairness to what the extent of what of the details, there's no details yet. The first repeal vote is really a call for Congress to create the budget reconciliation bills. The things that they said that were all on the table were CHIP and, you know, care, you know, all of medical assistance and care for pregnant women. So that they have not excluded anything from the possibility of getting this quote budget resolution, which, you know, reconciliation, which is a, you know, which they will, which is likely to be varied forms of budgetary cuts.
Okay.
But that they haven't said. They, like the president-elect, has not indicated too many details on what that is actually going to.
Okay.
State.
Now, faithless, cynical people such as myself think that that's probably because they have no idea what they're going to do. But other people seem to suggest that it's all a secret, and just because they're not telling me doesn't mean that they don't have a brilliant plan worked out. Do you have any indication of a brilliant plan behind the curtain?
I think that they have put out several concerns with thoughts of plans. One of the bigger plans that has been floated, and this has been something I'd run, is a series of very high deductible, largely catastrophic only insurance plans with health savings accounts attached, and increasing allowances for health savings accounts deductions on the income tax. But that's usually not very helpful for folks making under $35,000 a year with children.
Okay. What's the story I keep hearing about something about vouchers? What is that about? I haven't been able to figure that out either.
The voucher plans are instead of government established or heavily subsidized exchanges and plans, is just a series of vouchers, most likely vouchers in the form of tax deductions. Again, that would and those are the most common forms that one would apply to the cost of buying insurance privately.
Okay.
If one would go and say, I'm going to buy my local, you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield of upper Philadelphia, you know, and then to then apply the voucher piece to that if I have a certain income level.
Okay.
And can qualify.
All right. So when we return, we're coming up against a break here. When we return, I'd just like to sort of talk about how this will be impacting you as a physician. And we'll get back to this in just a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien and our special guest, Dr. Dan Conway. And we'll be back right after this to talk more about the repeal of Obamacare.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien and Dr. Dan Conway. We've been talking about the rollback of Obamacare, and we're having a stunning red letter day today. Something has happened that almost never happens on my show. We have a caller. Hello, caller.
Hey, Mark and Dan, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes, I can.
And this is Bill Broaddus from New Jersey. We've probably been talking to each other for years online, but first time over a phone.
Hello. Yes.
Mr. Broadhurst.
Nice to meet you.
Same here. My question is, and I'm obviously a layman Catholic, and I have nothing to do with the medical field, so I'm hoping my question comes at it from that perspective. A lot of people, even if I was to take pro-life people that have extreme capitalist ideology, you know, because obviously that's in history, that's America, and that's what a lot of pro-lifers want to believe. Why don't they think that they should be in the business of putting, you know, the Planned Parenthoods out of business in a capitalistic sense? So I know where Dan, I'm in New Jersey, obviously, central New Jersey, and I know where Dan is a doctor in Philadelphia. It's not just high poverty. There is deep poverty in Philadelphia and Camden, the poorest of the poor in this country. And why wouldn't, you know, just from a capitalistic standpoint, why wouldn't you want to put them out of business to help these women to make different decisions? That's question number one. And number two is, on the flip side, I think what does a lot of disservice is people have the word socialism and socialized medicine. They immediately think of the horrors of the 20th century, and they just immediately shut down. And I think that hurts dialogue. And there might be, again, I'm asking as a layperson, both Catholic and in medicine, does socialized medicine mean, doesn't necessarily mean government medicine. It just means insurance is provided for everybody. Those are my questions. I hope you could hear me, because I am commuting home in the car.
Mr. Broadhurst, I think it's actually fascinating. I ended up... Oh, crap.
You there?
There? Oh, no. Yeah, sorry.
I'm
thought I had... I thought that the... I lost the screen. I'm like, oh, my goodness. Skype's gone.
Now you're still here.
Great.
Okay.
And it's funny that for all this is, like, you know, the thought, and then the other piece that the other more recent strain in Catholic thought is this concept of libertarianism, of course, is somehow compatible with the faith, and that's like a stab to my eye. What is never done in there is this old concept, and it used to be in the preamble to the IWW, International Workers of the World, was that the creation of a new society in the shell of the old. That's if all of the high-end capitalism was that really that transformative, we would be talking about doing that concurrent or in advance of the demolition of all the social supports, as opposed to the thought that there will be a revolutionary event that reduces social supports, and then somehow the conservative libertarian Perugia will then result in the eternal spring of a new paradise. I'm not sure why we don't start seeing the work done before we need to start tearing down supports. Does that kind of go to the point you're making, Mr. Broadhurst?
I guess I find it, why don't they try? To me, if you help these women, especially the deep poverty, where I think deep poverty, you make less than $15,000 a year in South Philly and Camden. And so they're faced with a very harsh choice, and they make the one that we're supposed to be against, which is legal in this country, and Congress isn't going to change that. So why don't we compete with that option, and from a capitalistic standpoint? And then the other question is, can you explain what it really means to have socialized medicine? I don't think it means that you now, Dan Conway, become a government employee. And I think that's what a lot of people, I'm guessing, have a misinterpretation of. But I don't know. I'm asking you.
For the systems that I've seen that are, my wife is Australian, so I go to Australia and I have connections in medical field in Australia. The physicians can have a private practice, but their billing is all, for a large portion, comes through the government. So that then one becomes part, you know, that's the larger billing piece. That's how one manages revenue into a practice. The work that one does then is reflected in how much one bills the government for the activity. So that, you know, it's not, you're right, I'm not necessarily an employee of the government. In fact, it is the concept of health centers or health centers in impoverished areas result in, you know, that are kind of a distaff medical service that is likely to evolve as a consequence of disrupting supports like the ACA or medical assistance, private insurance. Those types of public clinics are closer to the idea of socialism. They probably tend up creating a two-tier type medical system of the place where all the poor people go, like the public hospitals that once were around, and then other places, the hospitals that the people with insurance go to. So I see that is a potential evolution of a world with less supports for such activities, private medical assistance, insurance plans. You know, and that it's actually more physicians employed, and you have more physicians dedicated to the inner city employed by the government as opposed to actual private practices that exist. Because I work in a larger academic type hospital, I have a very good relationship with actually private practice docs who have been around and serving this community for decades. And they're here and they're, you know, serving the community, but that will, you know, without medical assistance, they will have more struggles making ends meet and keeping revenue to keep the lights on in their clinics. So, but one of the things that another one of these unusual Catholic personas that Mark was talking about was Peter Morin, and he was someone who worked with Dorothy Day, and one of the things that he repeated was one of the aphorisms he was famous for is making it a society in which it's easier to be good, you know, where it's that was one of the interesting things that the folks of the new wave feminist group seem to be talking about, but using much more specifically abortion politics as the centerpiece of it. How do they making it easier to not have an abortion.
Exactly. So. This is one of the things that Destiny Herndon de la Rosa said when she was on the show the other day, was that they're not so much about trying to outlaw abortion as making it unthinkable. And that's a deeply Catholic approach, I think, that the reason that we have the abortion regime that we have is because it reflects who we really are, what we actually think and how we actually live. So 80% of the American people don't like abortion, and 80% of the American people have absolutely no intention of doing anything about it because it's thinkable. And so, creating that culture of life where it's easier to be good is
exactly. Yep.
Yeah, it's part of the work of what evangelists call pre-evangelization, of creating a culture, a sort of a cultural soil that's ready to receive the seed of the gospel.
You know, I guess my last question, and then I'll hang up and I'll listen to the app. and it's more for Dan. Dan, if you're an optimist of what a Republican Congress can replace Obamacare with under this universal health care, I'm imagining that they somehow make the exchanges more attractive to more insurance companies so there's more competition. I'm guessing, though. I'd like to hear your most optimistic outlook of what this Congress could do to replace it with. And I'm gonna hang up, guys, and just listen.
All right. Thank you for calling, Bill.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
I do have to say that I think that this state-level restrictions, and I'm not quite exactly sure the policy that created that state-level restrictions for insurance companies exist, that one has, you know, that you there's a policy for New Jersey and a policy for Pennsylvania and a policy for New York, and like there's companies that cannot sell products across state lines. I think that that does impact places like Oklahoma or Wyoming. I think that you know, individual, like, for insurance companies to exist, you need lots of people. You know, there needs to be lots of, you know, there needs to be a pool and to be able to share risk.
We're up against a break right now, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Dr. Dan Conway and Doug O'Brien here on Connecting the Dots right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Doug O'Brien and Dr. Dan Conway. Dan, or Doug, you were saying something during the break, and I wanted to give you the floor here.
Oh, it was just that the vote to repeal Obamacare is really a symbolic vote. That as I understand it, and as it's been reported in the press, is that repeal will not be effective until there is, in fact, replacement legislation. And they will move that replacement legislation, at least this is currently the plan, as part of a broader reconciliation package, which covers spending and savings across the entire federal government, which is why some other advocates for a whole life approach and the understanding of Catholic social teaching are also worried that there might be changes to child nutrition programs and SNAP, which used to be formerly called food stamps. So that there is a lot of programs that are possibly at risk in the reconciliation bill. But it does give the GOP Congress 6 to 7 months to look at various proposals. So as they replace Obamacare, they would replace them with in pieces and packages to be part of a larger reconciliation package. I realize that's kind of a complicated policy wonky thing, but I guess what I'm trying to say is I wouldn't panic just yet. There'll be chance for there to be a lot of push on what is in that package, but there should be real concern that millions of people may very well be cut off the program.
Okay. I just see in the news today that one of Trump's first acts as the pro-life savior of America will be to cut back 25 different programs that help protect abused women. So that will that's going to save a lot of lives, too.
That's largely from a policy document out of Heritage. He hasn't read it.
Yeah, of course he hasn't.
Right.
He doesn't like to read, as he said. And I wanted that gets me to something that I wanted to discuss in the last segment, which is simply the Trump factor. We're about to inaugurate a tornado as our next president. We don't know what he'll do because he lies constantly, and B, because he doesn't know what he's doing. and isn't really even clear on what the Constitution says or what his office entails. And so he just like threw this giant monkey wrench into the rollback of Obamacare earlier this week when he made this sudden announcement, who knows how serious he is when he makes it, that everybody's going to be insured. Now, it's worth noting that in one way or another, he's always said this. We saw this, for example, in the primaries. There was a discussion of Obamacare at one point, of health care at one point. And in the course of it, Trump, like the, you know, kind of classic wealthy New York Democrat that he's always been, remarked that if he saw somebody, you know, dying in the street, he wasn't going to just turn him away, right? Because noblesse oblige and so on and so forth. And so he was the guy, weirdly enough, who was saying, you know, of course you help the sick guy. You provide him with, you know, some kind of care. Meanwhile, Rubio and Cruz were both tag teaming against him, saying the only question that mattered to them, confronted with human illness and frailty, was who's going to pay for that? And so you wound up having this argument between somebody who was, you know, on the one hand, you had Trump saying we need to provide health care for that guy, and Cruz and Rubio both saying, no, just let him die. and that got reiterated.
Trump is the humane of the trio.
Yes, that was the amazing thing. Was Trump was the voice of humanity and compassion. And so earlier this week, Trump all of a sudden says we're going to have health care for everybody. And, you know, Ryan and the and the GOP are all like, wait, what? And so I was wondering if you could read your tea leaves or attempt to read the tea leaves and make any guesses about what might happen there if there turns out to be a civil war in the GOP between the repeal crowd, who seem to have no real serious plans about anything to replace it, and Trump insisting that he wants everybody to be covered, which would actually be better than Obamacare.
Exactly. And that was always one of the major criticisms with Obamacare from the left, was it's not far enough. What about all these people? You know, and there was no shortage of criticism of that. The fact that it went tried at some point to try to encompass some people or a bulk of people, another, you know, close to 20 million people on, you know, on the who received the ACA, you know, it became the line of resistance, but that was not really where a whole lot of activists wanted to move it. What would it look like for Trump to ask for such a thing? Well, I mean, politically and legislatively, that would be a fascinating discussion. I wonder what it would look like in reality. Would it look like insurance? It would probably have to look like insurance, because unless he creates a public option. You know, the public option was taken off the table to try to make it more acceptable to Americans and to the GOP back in 2010. Mm-hmm. A full on Medicare insurance that had to compete with, again, you know, Upper Philadelphia's Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance or whatever, just to know that that's not a real company. But mm-hmm. Yeah, Upper Blue Cross Blue Shield, you know, that was reviled by the insurance companies and the GOP, so that was mm-hmm. taken off the table very early on. Would he include a public option like that? That would be, that's one way in which one can insure everyone. Yeah. Is that type of an option with medical assistance expansion, not its reduction. And what a public option would do is it would a public option like that would be the major competitor for private insurance, for the private insurance options there on the market. So then they would have to they'd either have to go out of business or match the premiums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that people attracted to choose those other options. So that's one potential thing. Another potential piece is to remove ACA entirely and then have a huge increase in, different from their plan, a big increase in medical assistance in which there is a public hospital, public clinic system that is extensive and prevalent, which then creates that distaff arrangement for medical care. There's the poor people's medical care, and then there are people who have insurance as medical care.
Mm-hmm.
That's another way in which this could evolve.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to say, or he does away with medicals, does away with everything, and then tells everyone that everyone's insured, and they believe him anyway.
Well, you know, that's the weird thing, is that's entirely possible. You do sort of get the sense sometimes that Trump at some level believes that he'll walk into the White House and there will be the big insure everyone button on the president's desk, and all he has to do is press it and there it is. You know, I've made it happen. Well, it's a weird thing because he seems to be so often cocooned from reality by the way that he lies. I mean, it's such a strange thing. That's why I take none of this seriously until I actually see something happen. You know, so when he announces we're going to insure everybody, it's like, okay, do I get a pony too? Because, you know, I want to see it happen, you know. But it's fascinating to me because it was amazing to see, and foreboding to me, to see how little the left hand seems to know what the right hand is doing in the party of Trump right now. The fact that Ryan and Congress are completely blindsided by that statement tells me that there's not a lot of communication happening there, and that doesn't seem good for trying to construct some replacement for Obamacare.
No, I mean, and for as much as I will critique Paul Ryan, and you know, I have no shame in doing that. He's got the job, and I suspect that Trump, who is a CEO who has things done for him, who doesn't have people, and let me just say, he's accustomed to entire departments serving his will. The White House staff. You know, if it's anything like the TV show West Wing, the White House staff is not that deep, and he can engage policy people and bring them in.
Yeah.
You know, but he's going to expect something handed to him from the Congress.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. the roller coaster begins tomorrow. We will see then. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Dr. Dan Conway. Doug O'Brien, thank you for being here. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer was Danny Head, and we will be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about a life at the movies. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.